From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. This week, NPR is launching Climate Connections, a year-long exploration of how climate shapes people and how people shape climate. In this half hour, we'll hear one family's quest to lower their carbon emissions as part of our Carbon Counting Challenge. But first, we're going to take time to answer some of your questions. And to help us answer them, we've invited NPR science correspondent Richard Harris and from the World Resources Institute, Jennifer Lakey. Thanks to both of you for coming today.
Sure.
This topic has generated a lot of questions. So first of all, thanks to all of you in the audience who called and wrote to us. And we're going to begin with an email from Ronald Rossi of Jericho, Vermont, who writes, "Greenhouse gas emissions are constantly brought up as the root of temperature trends. Do we clearly understand this effect? And since we got so many variations of this question, let's start with a bit of a refresher here. What is the greenhouse effect and who coined the term? Richard?
Well, the greenhouse effect is a little bit of a misnomer because the idea is just the way the glass in a greenhouse traps heat in the greenhouse. There are molecules in our atmosphere that trap heat in the atmosphere, but they don't do it quite the same way as the glass does. But that aside, the idea is molecules like carbon dioxide will pick up some of the energy that's being reflected off the Earth and re-radiate it as heat. And this gradually builds up as the carbon dioxide builds up in our atmosphere, which it's been doing, and other gases as well, but carbon dioxide is the main one. So absolutely, truly, it is a real effect, and it is very closely measured.
And when did people start talking about this greenhouse effect?
I think the term emerged, as best we can tell, in 1937 in a textbook written by Glenn Thomas Trawartha. So the term's been around for a long time.
Okay, well, the next question is from a caller in Gardner, Montana.
Hi, my name's Abby Nelson, and I'm wondering what the distribution of carbon dioxide emissions is throughout different continents. In other words, what percentage of the rise in carbon dioxide emissions over the last century or two is the U.S. responsible for? And what percentage other continents are responsible for as well?
Jennifer Lakey, do we know the answer to that question?
The cumulative emissions in the atmosphere are the result of several centuries of emissions. And those in the last century, if we look about the 20th century, about 30% of the cumulative emissions have been the responsibility of the United States. Other continents and other countries are responsible for varying amounts, and their rates of emissions are growing or changing rapidly. Asia, for example, is only responsible for 20% of the cumulative emissions, while sub-Saharan Africa is responsible for only 1.7% of the emissions.
Hmm. Well, the next question we have is very basic and fundamental question about how we define climate change.
This is Sarah Purick in Chicago, Illinois. I'm wondering, how do you differentiate between a cyclical climate change and a permanent change in the climate and therefore the environment?
The question, how do we tell the difference between cyclical climate change, which does exist, yes, Richard, and some change that's different from that and perhaps more long-lasting, if not permanent?
Right, and that was debated for quite a while, and scientists have finally put that to rest because there are temperatures ups and downs, and what they've done is they've looked at the temperature trends over the last century or so, and they said, could this be just part of one of those normal patterns? And they say, no, the differences are large enough that it really goes beyond what they could possibly expect just from the regular fluctuations. So there's a scientific consensus now that we're on a trend that toward warming temperatures.
Well, the next caller is looking for some comparisons on emissions.
My name's Mark Scrog, and I'm calling from Boise, Idaho. I'd like to hear some sort of a cross comparison on sources of CO2 gases. For instance, how much CO2 is emitted a single jetliner taking off compared to how many cars? What would equal? What would be greater? That sort of thing, to try to put a face on the various sources.
Perhaps we can throw in how power plants contribute to it as well.
Yeah, I'll start with this one, which is we can say about 10% of emissions come from cars and light trucks around the world, and about 2%, 2 to 3% come from airliners. So when you look at the total emissions, they're down there, not insignificant, but not invisible either at all. So in terms of power plants?
Well, if you look across, and let me just take the example of a single unit because it gives you a little bit of a comparison. An average car in the United States emits 4.5 tons of CO2 equivalents into the atmosphere per year. A power plant, by contrast, is 8.3 million tons for a coal-fired power plant. And you think about the difference in the scale, you may be driving your car significantly, but the kind of power that you're choosing to purchase actually has a bigger impact over the lifetime of those emissions. difference between a hybrid and a SUV, however, is quite significant.
And the power plants are about 40% of our greenhouse gas emissions.
Well, that's still only accounting for about 60% of all the greenhouse emissions. Where's the rest coming from?
Industrial uses are a big part of it, and a lot of heating, for example, buildings are a huge consumer of energy. And yeah.
Globally, another source of emissions is actually land use change, and that's a difference between where the United States is in its development pattern and other countries like Brazil or Indonesia that have a very serious conversion going on from forests to agriculture in order to help development cycles.
Well, Jennifer, you mentioned SUVs and hybrids again, which brings us to an automobile question and one that has fueled a bit of debate for car owners.
My name is Celeste Budwitt Hunter. I'm from Houston, Texas. And my question is, what is the advantage to trading in my car and buying a hybrid, since someone else will be driving my car, and since there's a lot of energy expended in building a hybrid, a lot of carbon dioxide emissions, I would assume?
Now, Jennifer, as you've told us, that factory that's making the hybrid back in Japan is using up a lot of energy and is sending up a lot of emissions. So how does the equation work out?
Well, actually, from the perspective of the life cycle of emissions for an automobile, the majority of the emissions actually occur in the use phase. So it makes a big difference what you decide to drive.
Driving the car is more, that's creating more emissions than making the car.
That's right. Yes. So an average car in the United States, if you look at an average car for a sports utility vehicle, for example, you emit a ton of CO2 when you drive about 1,300 miles. We drive about 12,000, 14,000 miles a year. An average hybrid will emit one ton if you drive 6,000 miles. So it's quite a significant difference in terms of your annual driving.
And that's all a part of that 10% of emissions that we're attributing to cars and trucks. Jen McCooch of Atlanta, Georgia, called with a question about alternative energy, specifically nuclear energy.
What are the dangers of using nuclear power as a solution to energy consumption and production of energy in the era of climate change? Thank you.
Who's going to take that one? Jennifer?
I can answer that one. This is a really good question. It's a real dilemma that we're going to face over the next 20 years. How do we begin to think about where we're going to get our energy sources? If you think about the nuclear question, a couple of things you have to bear in mind. What are the costs associated with the technology, and what alternatives do we have? The cost associated with the technology, in this case, is a significant cost that's not cost competitive without subsidies. On the other hand, the cost of climate change could be astronomical compared to the cost of building a nuclear reactor. But the most important point from my perspective is actually, how do we begin to think about this from what alternatives we have? And clearly we have a lot of alternatives today that are available, like pursuing conservation energy efficiency, changing the temperature on in your household air conditioner or your heater.
But Jen was also she used the word danger in her question, and I think she may be expressing an apprehension that many listeners have, which is nuclear energy a more dangerous alternative to the other sources of energy we have because of radiation or because of what we do with the fuel?
Well, we certainly haven't solved the fuel challenge associated with nuclear energy or the long-term storage questions.
Well, the Great Lakes were a big topic of concern for our listeners, as in this call from Patty Kupfleisch of Columbus, Ohio.
Certainly we've heard about the oceans and icebergs and melting, but what will become of the freshwater supply that is made up of the Great Lakes?
The Great Lakes, Richard.
The Great Lakes. Well, I think nothing very much in the short run, the lakes themselves, but you do have to be concerned about changes in weather patterns and things like more air conditioning needs in Chicago and things like that. I mean, people around the Great Lakes will feel a lot of the effects, but the lakes themselves are not going to wither away.
Still be very good lakes.
Yes.
At least, here's an interesting question. It's about what we drink.
Hi, my name is Drew Malman. I'm from Wynwood, Pennsylvania. And my question is, do carbonated beverages add to CO2 production, which affects global warming?
Jennifer?
Well, what's interesting about the carbonation in our beverages is that we actually are mining for that CO2. We're emitting it all over the place, but we're mining for the CO2 in our beverages. And in fact, this is a very small portion of the overall CO2 that's emitted into the atmosphere.
Well, what do you mean by we're mining for that CO2?
We actually go underground to tap reservoirs of CO2 from underground storage sites. Many companies actually could bottle and share or distribute their CO2, but the market price hasn't been, and the distribution systems haven't been in place.
Okay, well, we'll move on now to a question we received from Washington State.
This is Joel Kearns from Kent, Washington. Since we've seen a huge boom in populations in the 20th century, how much of an impact has that had, just the sheer amount of people that have been seen on the globe?
What do you make of that, Richard? The population boom accounts for global warming?
That's been a very major factor. I mean, 60 years ago, there were, what, 2.5 billion people on the planet? There are 6.5 billion now, and in 20 more years, there could be 8 or 9 billion people on the planet. And as we grow in our population, our demand for energy increases dramatically.
Well, now to an email that we received from Jim France of Greensboro, North Carolina. It's about compact fluorescent light bulbs. And he writes this: the new fluorescents have pluses and minuses. They consume less power, but they contain mercury. How to decide whether to use them? What's the answer, Jennifer?
Compact fluorescents are actually a really interesting technology, and they are an important part of what we can do individually to change out our own footprint. The mercury issue is real, however. We hope that over the next couple of years, we're going to have a lot more recycling centers. EPA is initiating recycling centers around the country, and many communities are getting active with recycling as well, because the mercury is a hazard.
And I gather, Richard, that the mercury accounts for the packaging of the compact fluorescent light bulbs.
That's right. You get it in this really hard shell packaging, which is really annoying to get out. And I was trying to figure out, you know, was that really necessary? And the answer is yes, because apparently they do it in order to prevent the bulbs from breaking during shipping. And you don't want to get that mercury out into the environment.
Well, finally, we have a question about garbage.
My name's Kendall Christensen. I'm from Brooklyn, New York. My question is, what should I do with my banana peel if I'm concerned about global warming? Should I send it down my food waste disposer to a wastewater treatment plant and let it be turned into fertilizer? Should I put it in a garbage truck and send it to a landfill or incinerator? Should I compost it in my backyard? Thanks.
Well, I think that probably composting in your backyard would be the best option, because you might be able to turn it into a little soil carbon, and the carbon might stay in the soil. But the other options aren't too bad either. There's not much carbon in a banana peel to begin with. And let's not forget, the carbon in the banana started in the atmosphere. The banana plant grabbed it out of the atmosphere and put it in the banana. So even if you burn it or toss it in the landfill, you know, you can't really go too far wrong with your banana peel disposal.
Well, Richard Harris of NPR and Jennifer Lakey of the World Resources Institute, thank you both very much for talking with us today.
Thank you.
Sure.
And thanks to all of you for submitting your questions.